We are going to cover today 1 Kings chapter 9. It's not a terribly long chapter, 20-some-odd verses, thereabouts. 28 verses, I think it is. This is also, this chapter is paralleled in 2 Chronicles 7 from essentially verse 11 or so, onward through chapter 8 to verse 18. 1 Kings chapter 9. It happened, when Solomon had finished building the temple of the Lord, and the king's palace, and every desire of Solomon that he had wished to make, the Lord appeared to Solomon a second time, as he had appeared to him in Gibeon. The Lord said to him, I have heard your prayer and supplication that you supplicated before me. I have sanctified this temple that you have built, to place my name there forever. And my eyes and my heart shall be there all the days. And as for you, if you walk before me as your father David walked, with wholeheartedness and with uprightness, to do in accordance with all that I have commanded you, and you will observe my decrees and my statutes, then I shall uphold the throne of your kingdom over Israel forever, as I spoke to your father David, saying, no man of yours will be cut off from upon the throne of Israel. But if you and your children turn away from me and will not observe my commandments, my decrees that I have placed before you, and you go and worship the gods of others and prostrate yourselves to them, then I shall cut off from Israel, from upon the face of the land that I gave them, and the temple that I have sanctified for my name I shall dismiss from my presence. And Israel shall become a parable and a conversation piece among the nations. And this temple, which will be so exalted, all who pass by it will be astonished and will whistle and will say, why did the Lord do such a thing to this land and to this temple? And they will say, because they forsook the Lord their God, who brought their forefathers out of the land of Egypt, and they grasped the gods of others and prostrated themselves to them, worshipped them. Therefore the Lord brought all this evil upon them. It happened at the end of 20 years, during which Solomon built the two buildings, the temple of the Lord and the king's palace. Hiram, the king of Tyre, had supplied Solomon with cedar trees, cypress trees, and gold, according to his desire. Then King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee. Hiram left Tyre to see the cities that Solomon had given him, and they were not acceptable in his eyes. He said, what are these cities you have given me, my brother? And he called them the land of Kabul, which is the name to this day. Hiram sent the king 120 talents of gold. This is the description of the levy that King Solomon imposed to build the temple of the Lord, his own palace, the Milo and the wall of Jerusalem, Hazor, the Megiddo, and Gezer. Pharaoh, the king of Egypt, had come up and conquered Gezer and burned it in fire and killed the Canaanites who lived in the city. He gave it as a wedding present to his daughter, Solomon's wife. Solomon then built up Gezer and lower Beth Horon, Baalath, and Tadmor in the desert, near the populated land. And all the storage cities that Solomon had, and the chariot cities, and the cavalry cities, and every luxury of Solomon that he wished to build in Jerusalem, and in the Lebanon, and in all the land of his dominion. All the people were left of the Amorite, the Hittite, the Perizzite, the Hivite, the Jebusite, who were not of the children of Israel, their descendants who were left after them in the land, whom the children of Israel were not able to eradicate. Solomon conscripted them as indentured laborers until this day. But Solomon did not enslave any one of the children of Israel, for they were the men of war. They were his servants, commanders and officers, and the commanders of his chariots and his riders. These were the commanders, the commissioners, who were in charge of the work for Solomon, 550 men, who directed the people doing the work. However, Pharaoh's daughter went up from the city of David to her house that Solomon had built for her. Then he built up the Milo. 3 times a year, Solomon had elevation offerings and peace offerings brought upon the altar that he had built for the Lord, and had incense burned on the altar that was with it before the Lord. And he completed the arrangements of the temple. King Solomon also made a fleet in Ezon Geber, which is near Eloth, on the coast of the Sea of Reeds, in the land of Edom. Hiram sent in the fleet his servants, shipmen who knew the sea. Together with Solomon's servants, they came to Ophir and took gold from there, 420 talents, and brought them to King Solomon. That was 1 Kings chapter 9. Now, obviously, this is detailed matter. They're discussing the conclusion of the ending of chapter 8. Had already talked about the dedication of the temple, what they all did, all the various sacrifices, the various people who came to enjoy the time with God, and the wonderful blessings that Solomon gave to them. Well, at this time, that of course is concluding 20 years later, which both the temple and Solomon's palace were completed. The temple took 7 years. Solomon's palace took 13. It took a long time in his own home. But he did not start his home until apparently the temple was completed. It was a bigger push to complete that first before he worked on his own house. And we had discussed in great detail at the time the construction aspects, the components of each of the temple as well as the house, and what the symbolisms are built in around those items. And this is the time, of course, when all that's been completed. So Solomon finished it. Then, of course, God comes to him and talks. Are there any questions so far, in particular about chapter 9? The thing that brought your attention, or the things you said, well, what's that for? Why did he do that? It's a relatively simple chapter, nothing terribly complicated about it. It has a purpose behind it, much to Solomon's dismay. He doesn't know it. Well, he might know it, but the way this is written, there's a caveat that occurs to him, unfortunately for him, which we are fully familiar with, that God gives to him, says, hey, if you do good, you'll do good. Fine, I'll be good with you. But if you go the other direction, bad things happen. Of course, we already know the story of Solomon for the most part, and that his heart does go after other directions, and bad things start occurring to the latter half of his life. Any questions or comments so far? All right. Solomon hasn't finished building. 20 years go by, that's great, he's built a temple, he's built his palace. There's other things he still builds for the next few years. In 2 Chronicles, it points out that at this particular verse, it says, it's a verse 11 of chapter 7, it states that Solomon had finished the house of the Lord, the king's house, and Solomon successfully accomplished all that came into his heart to make in the house of the Lord and in his own house. So this 20-year event is regarding those two subject matters. The Milo that gets constructed, which Milo is landfill. He's filling in a large area of the city of Jerusalem to expand its borders. And it's on a mountain. What do? You fill it up and then you can expand out. He fills that out. David had already partially filled out the Milo area, but Solomon continues on to expand it. The city of David, of course, increases in size. So he still has more things to do over the next rest of his life, the following 20 years. But up to this point, this 20-year marker is the finish of the palace and the temple itself. The Hazor, Megiddo, Gezer, all the cities, the cavalry cities, and the various military cities, all those he built up and continued to build on and continued to expand them. We know this, for the most part, because of Solomon's son, Rehoboam. When the people came to him with Jeroboam with them, said, hey, Solomon's been hard on us. Back off. Release the taxes. Release what you're doing. And Rehoboam says, no, I have more to do. So, because Solomon wasn't finished, Solomon got a certain part done, Rehoboam has even more to build. Well, of course, he was harder on the people, and bad things happened to him later. But, so the construction projects don't end. Solomon's continuing to build. In chapter 3 of 2 Kings, God arrived or spoke to Solomon. There's a private conversation with the two of them. Well, actually, it's a one-sided conversation. I don't think Solomon said a whole lot. But God spoke to him in chapter 3. And said, if you do right, if you do well, I'll be with you. This is right after Solomon killed, I think it was like 1,000-some-odd sacrifices, and had already done many things for God and tried in the city of Gibeon, where the temple was at the time, or the temple, sorry, the Well, I guess, yeah, the temple was there, then the Ark of the Covenant was in Jerusalem. It's a little bizarre, the separation of the two. But, so he had built that, he did that back in chapter 3. This is the early part of Solomon's reign. He was just recently established as the king. He offers a bunch of sacrifices. God comes to him and says, if you do well, you'll be blessed. If you do poorly, you will not be. This is the second time God essentially says the same thing. There's a second witness from God to Solomon with the same conditions required. If you do well, you'll be blessed. Your kingdom will continue on. If you do poorly, it'll be destroyed. Well, in this chapter, it gives you, in some degree, a detail, which we'll discuss with a structure that happens to exist in the first part of this chapter, as to what God had in mind or was intending for Solomon's future and the future of all of his children, as well as, of course, for the temple itself and the people of Israel. That God knew at the time when he was making these declarations to Solomon that the future of the temple was going to be wiped out and destroyed. And God already knew that ahead of time. And he discloses that to Solomon in this conversation he does. And also, of course, the way this particular chapter is written, it gives you a great example of how God actually views, in his own personal idea and personal concept, views what the temple is. How he sees it, how he considers it, what value it actually is. God explains that within this chapter. We're going to discuss that as well. So he reasserts this whole purpose of this future for us, what's going to happen to Solomon as well as the temple with regarding the conditions. Now, Solomon, of course, when he does all this work in the building of the temple and his palace, who does he use to do all the work? Who's doing the labor? Foreigners. Now, what's happening to his citizens? What are they doing? Trade? Treating in charge?
There is
army. Also, is there this tax base that they don't want to make any money?
They weren't sitting around,
exactly. They weren't doing nothing. They had their work. They had their own lives to build. Now, I like this contrast when Solomon takes those who were not selected by God, and they are given to him, meaning the foreigners, they're still in the land, and those who are chosen by God are also given to him. And what does he do with each of them? He puts them to work, but they do different things. They have different purposes. I happen to like this particular chapter, even as John Walsh, who was last week, or had mentioned, regarding remember during the time of Passover about the indentured servant concept, that God purchased each one of us as his slaves. And it's good that we are his slaves. That's the desire for us, that we want to be God's slave versus anybody else's. Man's slave, the slave to a job, the slave to whatever you happen to be. It's God's slave is your goal. And that's a good place to be. That's the objective. So in this chapter, we notice Solomon's giving essentially two groups of people to do with as he wishes. What does he distinguish the differences? How does he handle both groups?
Well, for one thing, since you don't always know the attitude of foreigners toward the people of the country, he keeps them out of more dangerous positions. He puts the people that he knows whose loyalty is to the country in leadership positions.
That's true. You're absolutely right. He does put him down into a relative, not say obscure, that's not the right word, but in lower positions or lower places in the work and the service to do. So they don't get quite too close to the king. Now, at the same time, though, Solomon also surrounds themselves with multiple wives later on, with multiple countries from all over the whole world. So that's about as close as you get to the king as you can imagine, and then for some reason he keeps them away. So that's a strange scenario that he does that, but we'll discuss that. That actually is a reason why he does that, and it's symbolic of the Messiah in a different way. But we'll discuss that when it happens, when we get that point. But though it's bad, it wasn't all bad. It has its reasons. Any other comments regarding it? Yes, Anne.
It says that he gave, King Solomon gave Hiram 20 cities in the land of Galilee, so maybe that's where the foreign people all moved to those cities.
It's funny you mentioned that, actually. At this time in the history of the kings of Israel, as Israel and Judah are still obviously one country and still growing, the area of Galilee that he gave to Hiram was mostly, but not completely, populated by non-Israelites. For the most part, I mean, imagine you as a citizen, let's say you're a citizen of, you know, Santa Rosa, it's really close here, we all know Santa Rosa really well, and you're a citizen, and the president says, hey, China, you want a town? Here you go. How does that make you feel? Do you feel really valuable? Really important that your president really liked you? Not so much, right? Well, it just so happens that Solomon gave away very base, very simple agricultural towns, who, for the most part, in the Galilee area that he had chosen, appeared to be almost exclusively Canaanite populated. I do realize, yes, there were Israelites in and around the area. There was a tribe of Dan was up there. There were a few other members of some of those cities. But none of those particular cities, it appears, were Israelite, meaning Israelite-populated cities. They're mostly agricultural Canaanite towns, where all the Canaanites from the south ran to when Joshua came through and all the various kings came through. Now, Anne pointed out there, that he gives 20 cities. And why would Hiram not like them? Imagine you as a king, a relatively small country, because Hiram's territory, the city was Tyre, but that Lebanon, Phoenician area, it's not terribly large. So if you were granted 20 cities, which is a significant amount, it's not nothing, what would make Hiram say, no thanks? No, in Chronicles, it points out that Hiram essentially returns them back to Solomon. It says, you can keep them. I have no use for these. And as a subsequent result, Solomon then taxes his people a little heavier, which apparently is how he winds up paying Hiram for all the wonderful gifts that Hiram gave to him. But that's a separate topic. What was wrong with these particular cities that Hiram wouldn't like? Any ideas? What do you know about the king of Tyre? What does he do? Yes, Ellie.
Was it the amount of taxation and everything upon the people in those cities?
There was taxing. It was still a taxable area. Hiram's men, at the end of the chapter, it talks specifically about some of the men he owned, or he had with him. They're sailors. They were seamen he had. So what else was Hiram really good at? And note, when Solomon was building his temple in the previous chapters, what did Hiram do? He cut the trees down and sent it down through the sea, down into the territory of Israel, up the river. I forgot which river it was. He went down to Joppa, and I'm not sure where they went from there. Off the top of my head, I can't remember. He uses all the... He's a seaman. He does fishing, not so much. He does merchandise via... He's a merchant. He's a merchant marine. So yeah, essentially. Merchant marine's another way. So he ships. That's their expertise. Does a port city have a great use for a small agricultural town? Not really. They have some if they can produce something that's unique. But the whole area produces this kind of food, so it's nothing really unique they can produce. The deal is, Hiram has lots of money. How did he get his money? By trading. That's the business he's in. Not so much agriculture. That's what everybody else is in. So these cities are not worthless, but they are worthless to him because they don't gain him anything. It's just more towns he has to now defend. It's not a great tax base. How much can you squeeze out of a poor person? Very, very, very little. Not much. How much can you squeeze out of a rich person? A whole lot more than you can a poor person. So Hiram can't tax the base significantly with these 20 cities. They aren't worth very much. They don't have a lot. They're relatively poor. He can do far more out of a single town that's a port city. He gains far more value. So in his case, these cities aren't really worth anything. And in Chronicles, it points out, he gives them back to Solomon. You can keep them. I have no use for these. Thanks, but no thanks. Of course, it all brings the question, okay, if Hiram didn't like them, I wonder if Solomon cared for them or not. Yeah, probably not. Solomon may have said, you're right, Hiram, they really aren't anything, that's why I was giving them away. They're kind of a worthless town. we'll go back a little bit to what I was discussing with the servants and the slaves, essentially. What Solomon, he conscripted all the foreigners as essentially slaves. For all practical purposes, they were slaves. Now, being foreigners, they don't have the same rights as an Israelite citizen does as far as slavery is concerned. They don't have the 7-year rule. They have to have, be an Israelite rule for to get that 7-year release. And there's a lot of other details you can and cannot do the same way. Unless, of course, the foreigner says, okay, I give, I'll become Israelite citizen, and it says, okay, now all the rules apply to you, you're freed. But he conscripted these individuals, he contrasts the difference, and I want to point out the difference he contrasted of how he used them both. Oh, sorry, go ahead, Anne.
He says forced labor, but then in my scripture it says, as it is to this day. I mean, do they, yeah, so.
There isn't really a release to foreigners. The release isn't done like it is Israelites. Yeah, I think it's a 7-year rule for call for Israelites. For foreigner release, the 50-year time slot. It's a little bit longer. You could say a little bit longer. First Kings, the timing. Oh, okay. At the time which this particular topic appears to be written, I can't say for certain who wrote it when. First, second, third and fourth books of Samuel. Never heard of that. Third and fourth book of Samuel. First Kings used to be called the third book of Samuel. And Second Kings used to be called the fourth book of Samuel. Now, Samuel did not write all these books. He wasn't alive through most of these. He died, I think, if I recall correctly. He dies really early on, maybe the second book. But they're originally called that. So it implies that whoever wrote them writes them all the way through until the destruction, essentially 2 Kings, the end of 2 Kings, through Jeremiah's time, or up to that point. But that's at the end of it. So this has been updated or chronicled, another way of wording it, over the time. So whatever this particular moment it was written down for Solomon, we're not sure when, because the kings span hundreds of years. This moment in time, most likely was written, since it says, to this day, it happened to some time after the event that's being described. Whatever this day means, I can't say. I don't know. Based on some of the comments that have been inserted in here, you can generally speculate this seems to be prior to the dividing of the kingdom with Rehoboam and Jeroboam, that it was written sometime before that moment, but hard to say. So we're looking at least 20, give or take, years after the events being described here, it's being written, maybe a little bit longer. It's hard to say for certain, though. So they're still in slavery when the guy's writing it. What I wanted to point out, the difference between the slave and the non-slave and the servant. The servants were all Israelite, right? They have certain protections that God granted them, because they're God's people. The slaves were non-Israelite. They don't have those same protections. They were not God's people. Well, we know that Solomon is supposed to be a messianic figure. The wisest man on earth, abundant wealth, the whole world flocks to him. He's the greatest there ever was, the greatest of all kings. Obviously, it's a very messianic pointed figure. So, in the Messiah's time, when he's supposed to come again, what groups of people exist? Those that are his, given to him by God as God's inheritance, say, here you go, and those that aren't. What does Messiah do with both of these groups, theoretically, if we use Solomon as the example? Some are slaves, some are servants. They all serve him, but they serve him in two different capacities. So I like this particular chapter when it comes to Passover time, because it gives me the example of, well, God purchased all the Israelites back at the original Exodus and through, of course, Messiah's time. He purchased them with his own cost. It cost him something. He bought them. And that gives him a particular group of individuals, also classed as the Israelites, or the inheritance that God owns, versus those who have no value or do not value or don't use, but rather reject, God at the time, whenever throughout their lives, each individual person is unique. But that group is over here on this side. Messiah, what does he do? Does he just slaughter one group and keep the others? No. He receives them both from God, both groups. So our Messiah, we would expect, see, there are those who, quote, belong to God, given to him. He's going to use them. All right, he has them in this group over here. There are also those who rejected God, but still are there. Messiah says, okay, I'll take those group and send them over here. I have two groups of individuals. I will use them both in different capacities. Yes, Joshua.
Yeah, is that second group that you're referring to not his people, the ones that like Isaiah and somewhere else talks about they'll be commanded to come to Sukkot, and if they don't, the rain doesn't fall on them and this and that?
Along those lines, I would be speculating, but that's what I would incline to believe, but I don't know for certain. In that, because those who have been chosen by God and selected, these are mine, these are my gift, or these are my bride, in other words, of wording it, that's been given to my son as his, that's that little group, alright, that's the little group of people. That there are also the guests of the wedding, there are also those who are outside who didn't make it in, and lots of other things, and people that are also exist. Does God just slaughter them all? Say, okay, we're all done with you, there is no second resurrection for you, you're done. Or does God say, okay, yeah, you died this one, but I'll still use you. There is still application for you. In Solomon's case, I use that example as well. It appears to me that there is an application still. They still have a purpose. Yeah, the rules may change for them as far as what they do and don't get to inherit or do. I can't argue that necessarily. But it appears there seems to be at least two classes of people that Solomon's utilizing, both as his servants, but doing two different tasks. Just my personal opinion. Okay. Any questions so far? Okay, direct your attention this way. In this particular chapter, now this is nothing terribly new to any of you. You've seen these structures I do before. And there's nothing terribly profound in the chapter itself that something, you know, new is being taught to us. It's stuff we already are fairly familiar with because we know the story of Israel. But at this time, Solomon's still living this part, or at least maybe he just recently died. We're not sure exactly when this passage was written, as we're talking to Anne about a few moments ago. But inside this particular chapter, there is a structure that exists. Now, this particular structure is a little bit, I use the term dirty, meaning because it is not a complete paralleled mere image. I'm going to draw something on the board real quick. I'm going to erase part of this story. Erase this comment here. So at least I can discuss a little bit about how the structure is written. You guys have seen the most common structure I talk about, right? You have the first half matches the latter half, and they all go point toward the middle. The middle is your attention point. That's what you draw your attention to. Well, this structure is not written that way. This is the second most common version of it, which is duplicates in the same order. So it has, for example, I have A, B, and C. Oops, sorry, that's a D. I can draw C over here. And then later in the chapter, I have an A, B, C prime. I call them primes, they're similar. In the same order. They're not mirrored of each other, they're just duplicates of each other. This particular structure does a unique teaching. It's what it does. There's also a topic D here. Sorry, I did this right. It's A, B, C, D on one side. This one, instead of A, B, C, D prime, it actually reorders C and D. So it reorders them in the second part of the structure here. The reason that it's most commonly used to do this, and it's actually, this is a very frequent tool throughout your Bible. The reason it's done that is that God is telling us through this message, doing this process, is that you have A, B, C, and D over here. We already know that A and A match. It's telling you that the C on this side is going to become or is like the D topic on that side. And the D on this first side is going to become or is like the C topic on that side. It's trying to tell you what's going to happen to this is going to be converted over into that. As opposed to they are the same, no, they will become the same. They will turn into that. This is how the structure is written. This one starts out, of course, verse 1, it points out that Solomon finished building the house of the Lord and the king's house, and it was all great and wonderful. Well, in verse 10, it all talks about the same thing. It happens to repeat almost identically. When Solomon had finished building the two houses, the house of the Lord, the king's house. Both items, both verses, verse 1 and verse 10, talk about the exact same thing. Now this word is somewhat interesting. And the second topic it talks about in verse 2 and 3, more specifically verse 3, it says that the Lord said unto him, I have heard your prayer, thy supplication that you have made before me. Now, about a month ago, I think it was, I talked about what was the difference between a prayer and a supplication. Do you remember what the difference was? Does anybody remember what the difference was? A prayer is a context. It's what you're saying. Here are the words, are blah, 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 blah. That's the prayer. The supplication is begging or pleading. I don't deserve for you to answer any of the things in the prayer I just asked. I'm asking for your compassion and give me something that I don't deserve. Please. Have you asked your parents, can I please have this when you're a little kid? Can I please have the cookie? Can I please have that toy? Please, please, please. I know I kicked my sister earlier, but can I please have the toy anyway? What kid doesn't do that? Every kid does that. We all have done that. So that's the supplication part, the pleading part, that you don't deserve it, but you're asking for it anyway, versus the context of what you actually need. Okay, God bless this food, or God bless my efforts, God bless my future. Those are the prayers you're talking about. The pleading part of it is the please, 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 please. That's what supplication is. Solomon did exactly that with the king of Tyre, Hiram. He asked, can I please have your cedar trees, your cypress trees, and your gold and your rocks? Can I please? Because you really liked my dad. Big smile on his face. You know. And Tyre said, okay, sure. There you go. I did like your dad. You're a good man, I think. So, you know, you're young, but we'll go and give you the benefit of the doubt. I'll give it to you anyway. So, this is what I like about this, that Solomon's supplication before God, we read about that in chapter 8. But Solomon actually also supplicated to Hiram, the king of Tyre, which talks about down here. The king of Tyre had furnished, actually, I didn't read all of this, all the stuff down. The Solomon's, the cedars, the cypress, and the gold, all that according to his, meaning Solomon's, desire. When you're pleading from God, are you pleading your desire? Are you pleading your please? It's because you want it, right? So this supplication that Solomon makes to God in verse 3 is a copy of his supplication that he did according to all of his desire in verse 11. They're both talking about Solomon's desire, Solomon's pleading, his wanting something. So I like that particular one. It's just interesting to note that you can use the supplication in that way. It's just funny. It's my personal thing that I happen to like. So, God says to Solomon, in continuing on in verse 3, that he had hallowed or sanctified or set aside this house to put his name there. Now, what is hallowed? What is sanctified? What does that mean? What are you physically doing? You're setting apart. You take a group over here, you're putting it over there. You're setting it independent from all the rest of them, right? That's what God said. I've hallowed, I've sanctified, I've set aside this building that you've built according to, I will put my name there. What did the king of Tyre do? What did Hiram do when he got to see the 20 cities? Now, Solomon gave, also known as saying, Solomon set aside, Solomon pointed out, here are yours separate from mine, 20 cities. So Solomon's doing the separation, just like God did the separation. So God is sanctifying his temple, and Solomon is sanctifying, meaning setting aside, the 20 cities to the king of Hiram, or king of Tyre, Hiram, the king of Tyre. And what does Hiram then immediately do? He leaves Tyre and goes to the cities when a king enters a town as the triumphant owner. What does it do to all the residents? Oh, hey, look, he's the new owner. Nice to meet you. Not always. No, they may not like it. But the king puts his name on the town, doesn't he? Now all the residents now know they belong to this guy. He's putting his name there by walking through with however many officers or friends he may have with him and observing and looking at what do I own now is what he said what he's doing. What is belonging to me? So the king of Tyre, he does essentially what God does. He leaves his place to set aside put his house, he sets aside these cities. Solomon did that part. And Hiram puts his name there by going out to see them. And God put his name there forever. Now, here's the difference, though. These cities didn't please Hiram, the king of Tyre. He didn't like them. Did God like the temple? Well, apparently, yes, he did. He points out in verse 3 still, it says, "My eyes and my heart shall be there." Now, I like the term, he used the word heart. You know, I know some of your scriptures will say, my eyes, my ears will be there, but the heart is a better translation, in my personal opinion. So my heart will be there. Was Hiram's heart at the cities? No, his heart was not there. So God's making a contrast, the scriptures make a contrast at least, between God's heart being with the temple, and the building in particular, but temple specifically, compared to Hiram's heart not being with the cities. That's going to come into play in a few minutes. That's why I want to bring it out to you. We'll come back to that shortly. But there is an important difference between the two. This is where the topics A, B, C, D switch. This point, which, you know, if God points out to him, to Solomon, that the integrity, if you're upright in your integrity of heart, your uprightness, I will establish the kingdom forever. He brings over that, and that is in the place, or right where you would expect to have it down here, in the second half of the structure, located in verse 13, the latter half of verse 13. Oh, sorry, I got it right. So, in this one, what does the king of Tyre claim about the cities? It says the land of Kabul, which means worthless or shackled, actually. It's a shackled land. It's of no value to him. And the term shackled is actually the proper word for it. It's a shackled land. Like as in like shackles on your feet or shackles on your hands. You are enchained or you are imprisoned by it. So this place where God's blessing Solomon, that in the integrity of the righteous, I will establish the throne and the kingdom forever, that's a great blessing. But instead of that, you'd expect some topic down here about the wonderful gifts to king of Tyre. You do not get that topic. You get the gift is a chain to me. It's a shackle to me. It's worthless to me. Get it away from me. I don't want it. Continuing on from verse 7 or so, it talks about the next topic down. This house, which I have hallowed for my name, this is the wonderful thing that God was talking about, I have a name I will dispose of or cast out if you are disobedient to me. Well, that same topic, and the Israel become a byword and a proverb of the nations, this same topic you would expect down here in the other half of the structure, a same negative topic, but it's not. Instead, down here you have a blessing that Hiram sends the king 64 talents or 120 talents of gold. So, my point is, so far, if I haven't made it clear yet, is that in the topic structure, God's doing this. Instead of making them all in nice, neat order, he points out over verse 4 and 5 or so, that he will bless you. It's a blessing topic. And in the bottom half of the structure is a worthless, shackled, disgusting, worthless piece of garbage. So it's a cursing topic. And the next part down from verse 7 or so, it points out that this house that I've hallowed or set aside for my name's sake, I will kick out, discard, get away from my presence, I don't want to see it again. That is a cursing topic. And you'd expect to see a cursing topic at the bottom, but you don't. Instead, you see a blessing topic, verse 14. Hiram sends the king 120 talents of gold. So with this structure being built for us, using this style, what's God telling all of us through this particular chapter? Well, it tells us that regarding the blessing topic for Solomon's house, at some point in time or in some fashion, it is equivalent to a curse. And regarding the cursing topic of God's house, the temple, at some point or some way, in some fashion, it's going to turn into or become a blessing. He's switching them. By switching them, what is he telling Solomon? Assuming Solomon could read this, you know, outside of living it. If he could read this textual context of how it's written the way it is, and pretending he wasn't alive at the time, but you're reading it, you know, a couple hundred years later. What would it tell him? It would tell him that the integrity and Solomon's righteousness and the establishment of his kingdom upon Israel forever will become worthless or shackled burden upon him. Upon him and his house in particular. His kingdom is the topic up here. We're talking about kingdom in particular, of course, Israel forever. But it's talking about his kingdom will become shackled. It will become worthless. It will become chained. It will become damaged. Of no value to anyone. And it also tells him, regarding this topic down here regarding the temple that God had sanctified with his name, he will cast it out of his sight, and Israel become a proverb or byword among the people, will become a blessing. Now, 120 talents of gold, you may not argue is a whole lot. That actually is a whole lot, but it's a lot. it's millions and millions of dollars. It's quite a few tons of gold. I think it's almost 16 or 20 tons of gold. It's a lot. He's telling Solomon that I'm going to convert your house from the blessing that it could have been into a cursing. It will be destroyed. It will be shackled. It will be chained up. And I'm going to convert the building which you've given me and the people which are mine, but the building which you built, I will convert that into a great blessing. Now, we know the history of what happens to Solomon and all the various kings, right? We've read this story before. This is old hat for most of us. We already know that Solomon does precisely what he was told not to do here in this chapter, and also the chapters too. He winds up giving his heart away to multiple women, doing various things regarding incense burning of different gods and goddesses, and does things that God abhors. What happens to Solomon's house? It falls. It gets divided up heavily initially, right after shortly after his death. And years later, it finally just collapses down in itself. It's destroyed. It becomes a wasteland, a good for nothing. How many of us know the story of Israel? We talk about, oh, don't be like the kings. Don't be like that king. Don't be like King Ahab. Don't be like all the various kings there are. How many of us know those stories? Don't be like them. Does that mean it's become a byword? Become a proverb? Yeah, it became exactly that. It became a byword of proverb. So Solomon's house became that. Israel became that. But Solomon's house, which could have been a great blessing, remains a shackle, remains wasted. Not David's house, mind you, but Solomon's house. God's house will become at some point a great blessing. But that also means, since it's going to become a great blessing, it has to go into a great cursing first. It has to get destroyed first before it becomes a great blessing. It's an interesting structure in and of itself as far as how God wrote it down. These are old things. They've been around for thousands of years, literally. So there's nothing new with inside the text that we already don't know. But it's interesting to me the way God uses them to teach us these things. That we can then definitively say, at some point, although we already know for other verses as well, that the temple, the house of Israel, will become a great blessing. And apparently, the way Solomon used the house of Israel versus slaves, their blessing will be a serving of Messiah. That's their future task. We know that much, based on just what this chapter tells us, and how the structure is written. So we know the house of Israel will get destroyed, as it describes here. The house of Solomon will be cast off my side. Israel will be a proverb by. We know that's going to happen. We already know it did happen. But at some point, those individuals will become the great blessing to Solomon. And Solomon used those individuals that God gave to him as servants within the same chapter. So it tells us that those individuals would become blessed servants of the Messiah. And the contrast is also true. That Solomon's house, which was great, gets completely destroyed and is then worthless. It doesn't come back. No, it stays worthless. Stays gone. Unlike the king of David, this is we're talking the king of Solomon. There's a different kings. So David has a promise of a man will continue on to exist. And a Messiah will come from his line. It never says the line of Solomon. It says from the line of David. From the tribe of David. From the root of Jesse. It doesn't talk about the root of Solomon. It talks about one particular man, not the other one. Even though they're related, it doesn't matter. It's the topic Solomon's house and the way it's structured and done, the way he conducts it, is going to be wiped out and destroyed and nothing will ever remain of it. It will become a burden. A shackle. Yes, Ellie.
You talk about it being a byword. Half of that division was called the 10 tribes of Israel. No, they were called the lost 10 tribes. And they became a byword. Everybody figured they all died. Nobody knew where they went. And yet in reality, they went around the world and the Messiah attached himself to those. So they turned out to be a terrible division and lost. And what did they do? They brought the Messiah to the world.
A great blessing. A great blessing in itself. So it is a process which a blessing turns into a curse in this particular story. The blessing of God, the blessing of what can happen to Solomon's kingdom, the blessing of the temple itself, goes through a curse process. But at the end, the temple and the people are the ones that survive. They're the ones that come out on top. They're the ones who succeed in God's blessing. Any questions? Does it make sense? It's a fairly simple topic. It's not complicated, fortunately. Sometimes they are. I happen to enjoy this structure because I like the fact that it points that out. I enjoy the point that the details that I have to the details that I read about in Solomon's temple and Solomon's kingdom and how he does stuff are literally details. Although they're prophetic, they are details that I don't worry about the focus of the details all about Solomon. They're not supposed to be about him. It's still focused because all that stuff will be destroyed and gone away with and wiped away and washed away and be gone. What he does and his great wisdom or his life or his wives, whatever he has, all that I know from at least this chapter alone will become completely destroyed and nothing left of it of any value. That's great to understand that and know that because he does some really nasty things. As the wisest man who ever lived, he wasn't always so wise in some topics. So it's beautiful for me to see that, all right, David was enormous and is enormous in my personal mind of a type of messianic character he was. But I know that the Bible points out Solomon was far greater than David in many, many ways. But Solomon, as far as God's concerned, is worthless. So it brings you back to David. It continues to point to you, okay, this great grandiose thing that Solomon becomes and became is worthless. Remember that, Daniel. It means worthless. It's garbage. It still has great stories, great information, great prophecy within it. That doesn't matter. The result, the creation of it, and what it has become and becomes, is, as far as God's concerned, worthless. His focus is solely upon David. And the distinction between David and Solomon, the biggest distinction there is, Solomon did all the Proverbs, which we think of as wisdom. David did all the Psalms, which we think of as heart. So what does God value? Your wisdom or your heart? Your heart. So all the wisdom you can gain, all the studying I can do, and all the chiastic structures I can locate, it's just stuff. It's just information. It's fluff. It's fun. Interesting. It's just, but it's not great value. It's the David part to refocus my attention to. Yes, Hank.
You know, the main thing is it's how we finish.
It is.
You know, and that's what we see with David and Solomon. It's not that David didn't sin greatly.
He made mistakes. Yep.
But he finished well. His heart returned or teshuvah. Mm-hmm. Solomon did not.
Divided.
And so Solomon, you know, it's like those who do righteously and at their end do evil, them I will blot out of my book. Those who do evil and then in their end are righteous, then I'll write into my book. It's that simple principle with God. It's not what we start off doing, it's how we finish.
Right, right. And that's a beautiful part of it. And that's what I like about Solomon and his story. I can learn those things and remember them as I'm going through it. Because unfortunately, maybe you guys don't, I get lost in details real quick. Ooh, wow, that must have looked really pretty. Oh, wow. Imagine what I'm reading and get lost in what I'm reading and not focus on, okay, wait a minute. This stuff is symbolic only. The actual gold itself is dirt. The wood themselves is nothing. It's, you know, bug food. Though they are attractive and pretty and they have their own symbolism, that's all they are. Just focus on the symbols alone and discard all of it. Because David is the one who designed half this stuff, not Solomon. David is one of the main designers. He's the one who laid out half this the temple. He's the one who told him how it was all going to be built. So it's David's heart that you're actually trying to read when you read Solomon's temple. It's David's heart, not necessarily Solomon's palace, but at least Solomon's temple. David has his own house. So the temple itself, you're looking at it, read David's heart while you're reading it. And understand where his heart was while you're going through the details. Getting lost in the prettiness of it loses you. Though it is very beautiful. That's not the point. That's what I like about this story. I like about Solomon's story because it reminds me, as I'm going through it, as Hank just pointed out, David's heart did return. What did Solomon's heart? Divided into 700 different ways? For all the different girls that he went through. So his heart was divided, never returned to God, and David's did. And it's always beautiful to remember to do that. Remember to focus on that. It's a great part of the story. Great part of what God's trying to teach us. And I like this particular structure because, again, as many others do, it points out that contrast. That this stuff you see is garbage. It will become a burden or a shackle to you, become a prisoner to you. Or you become a prisoner to it. Sorry, it's the right word. And that's exactly what happens to Judah. They become prisoner to, literally actually, to Jerusalem. They actually get imprisoned inside of it for a while, for a few years there, as a tribute to the very end. Any questions or comments? Yes, Joshua.
Yeah, I thought it was interesting that you talked about, David and the Psalms, and then Solomon and the Proverbs. I never thought of it that way, but I'm reminded of that scripture of Yeshua, the woman at the well, about the Father is looking for those who will worship Him in spirit and in truth. And now to me, it seems like David with the Psalms and how he poured out his heart before the Lord, and then Solomon with his words of wisdom, you know, as far as the truth and the mind and understanding and get understanding. That seems to shed light on that, you know.
You're absolutely right. The wisdom that God gave to Solomon was fantastic. It was still a wonderful gift of God. So wisdom isn't evil, quite the opposite. I wasn't arguing that at all, don't get me wrong. Wisdom is fantastic. Heart is also fantastic. When the wisdom turned you in the wrong direction, it became a curse to you. But if you have the wisdom, you have the heart of God, that's perfect. And Solomon started out that way, virtually perfect, because he had the wisdom of God in him. He just went haywire toward the end, which what happens. But don't get me wrong. I don't say that God. I don't want me to imply that God only desires your heart. That's not true. If He has your heart and you're a dunce, there's not much can be done with you until He fixes your head. You need wisdom too. Wisdom in God. Wisdom understanding what He wants from you. That's of value to him. Then he's a really, really good tool. A tool that's rusty isn't so good. It's great to have the tool, but it's still rusty. You have to sharpen it up a little bit. Wisdom has that sharpness to it, has that value. So that's great to use them both. And both, that's why, hence the Proverbs and the Psalms are together in the same book. You can read them both. They're great and all. But it's what Solomon does. Not the words, but actually what he does in his house and how he conducts his house that gets wiped away. Where his personal wisdom of men led him. That was the wrong direction. That's what I wanted to focus on. And the stuff he builds, the prettiness of that, the extra details he added onto it, they're just details. Thank you for your time. Have a wonderful rest of Shabbat.